Hey, what's up, people? Welcome to In Too Deep. I'm your host, Jack Rowland. I hope you're all ready for a bloody good episode, as I'm very excited for this week's guest. Today, I'm joined by the incredibly insightful Zach Leary. Zach is a writer, a psychedelic advocate and facilitator, host of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, podcast, practitioner of Bhakti Yoga, spiritual student of Ramdas, and of course, the son of the late, great Timothy Leary. Zach grew up with a front row seat to some of the most important cultural movements of the late 20th century, resulting in him creating a truly unique personal and professional path for himself. Zach and I met a number of years ago at the Ramdas Retreats in Hawaii, an incredibly special place and time in my life, so always grateful to reconnect with some of that energy. All right, I hope you guys enjoy this chat. Let's get deep with Zach Leary.
Is there a point to all this?
I think we're getting in too deep.
You don't apply. Bad luck.
Oh, I have one speed, I have one gear. Go, 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 go.
I'll tell you when we're getting in too deep, too deep,
too deep, 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 deep.
Zach, how are you, buddy?
Hey, Jack, great to see you.
Yeah, you too, man. It's been a while, so just kind of repeating everything we've just said. But
the miracles of technology, you're down under, I'm here.
I know, right?
But here we are.
Here we all are. Yep, totally. Yeah. You're living in Austin now, right?
I'm in Austin, yeah, about 2 years. Yeah, just a little over 2 years.
Right. How are you enjoying it?
Yeah, it's been good. I mean, you know, I've been basically in LA my whole life. I sort of left a couple times, a few false starts here and there, but I really never left Los Angeles, and I finally decided it was time to try something new. Austin is good. It's a much quieter way of life. Los Angeles is definitely noisy in more ways than one, you know, internally and externally. So it's been good. It's been a good change for me.
Yeah. I loved both cities. I loved Austin a lot. So much incredible music, food, just good vibes. And LA as well. I mean, everyone gives LA, you know, it's got a strange, unique buzz and vibe to it, right? You know, very transient city and stuff. But I loved it. Like, from an outsider's perspective, there's nothing more exciting than LA for me, really.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the one thing about Los Angeles, it's like, you know, living there certainly presents its problems. Mm. Like, you know, I'd lived my whole life, things like traffic, cost of living, and kind of just the general hustle of Los Angeles gets to be a bit much after a while. But say what you want about it, there are more creative people per capita in Los Angeles than anywhere else. You know, people making music, making film, art, tech, psychedelics, yoga. You know, Santa Monica, Venice is one of the great yoga hubs of the world. Meditation. There are so many people doing great works in Los Angeles that it is kind of hard to knock it. You know, it really does have an incredible, like, buzz of people making stuff. And I do love that.
Yeah. Everywhere is so iconic too. I mean, like, when I was there and visiting you and stuff, you know, the giant Scientology building's right there. And you're like, yeah, that used to be a hospital. Now it's a cult.
It's where I was born.
You were born in the Scientology epicenter.
I was. It used to be the old Cedar Sinai Hospital until, I think, 1978 or something. I was born earlier than that and was born there. So every time I drive past it or I see it in the Scientology docks, I'm like, that's where I was born. Strange karmas, right?
Yeah, totally, totally. Hey, have you been, obviously we met at the Ramdas Retreat probably quite a few years ago now. I mean, what, coming up to like 7 or 8 years, I think. It's crazy how quick things go. Have you been kind of getting back to retreats and things throughout this weird, tumultuous time?
Yeah, I know. It's been strange, right? Mm. I haven't been to a Ramdas, a Maui retreat in a while. Mm. I mean, I keep in touch with Satsang, and I've been to some more, I guess, mainland, what we call the mainland here, retreats, some smaller kind of things. But no, I haven't been to a Maui retreat in quite a while, and I'm itching to go. You know, I haven't been since Ramdas left his body, you know. Mm. But yeah, I don't know. Have you been since he died?
I have not, to be honest. I bought a ticket. that was just before the pandemic, and I've tried to go since. Just hasn't quite worked out. But to be completely honest, I was really nervous to go back to retreat, given how much division has hit our society, like the world, through the pandemic. I was like, I just have to keep this idealized version of that utopia sacred in my brain. I it would break my heart to go there and have a vax debate with anyone or witness a vax debate, you know, in this beautiful environment. So I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna bask in the chaos for a bit, and then when I feel the waters are a bit calmer, then I think I'll go. But
yeah, no, I feel you on that. And you know, and there was a lot of well, depends. I'm not trying to open up the door for any debate, but depends, I suppose, what side of the fence you're on. But you know, a lot of
I don't care.
What we would call disinformation made its way into the yoga community, into like the greater new age yoga meditation community, and a lot of people kind of within that community became sort of purveyors of the disinformation thing, and that it bothered me to no end. You know, yeah, you know, as much of a, you know, I am a very spiritual person and I rest in that place, but I also, you know, science is our friend as well. And I also know many people who were greatly harmed from COVID, even some that died. So it hit me pretty hard. And I don't know, it was a complicated issue, but yeah, for sure. When those two worlds collide, it's very upsetting to to have to hash it out under that context.
Oh, absolutely, you know, and That's the funny thing about that place and those beautiful people and teachings. It's meant to be the breakaway from that. But it's just such weird times that we've found ourselves in. I feel that things are starting to calm down. I feel that people are now opening up. At least in my world, people are now opening up to listening to the other side, both ways. Yeah. And that's a really good thing, I think. I don't know. It's tricky. It's a tricky with that world, you know,
it is very, very tricky. And I think, you know, the one thing I will say about COVID, now that a little bit of time has passed and, you know, I certainly think COVID is here to stay. I think it was a really interesting, blueprint for something much bigger that could come, you know, right, for how these discussions will show themselves, how heated people will get, how quickly we can see false narratives and, you know, weird little bits of junk science take hold and become mainstream. I think COVID is just the tip of the iceberg. You know, the next thing could be a lot more serious. And, if COVID was any kind of litmus test, you know, I mean, Ram Dass used to talk about this all the time, like, especially when he had a stroke, he failed. He didn't pass the test,
right,
you know?
Right.
You know, and I think we didn't really pass the test with COVID. So I hope we've learned from it and that the next time around, perhaps we can find some middle ground and not, you know, rush to our respective echo chambers.
I love that you bring that up. You know, the story that Ram Dass tells when he has the stroke, and he's dealt with that moment where his entire life worth of spiritual work, this is when you need to call on it. And is it, you know, exactly like you put it, are we going to pass the test? And it's a scary thing to kind of think about, isn't it? It's Oh man, I love Ram Dass.
That's a great story. And you know, he tells it, there's a few different ways that he tells it, but I just love that image where he's lying there having just been, as he called it, stroked, and he was like, here I am, Mr. Spiritual. and I'm not ready, you know, I'm not ready to die. I failed the test, and which just showed him, you know, how much more work he had to do. And of course, it was, Ram Dass's testament for all his life post-stroke is incredible, because he was in that chair for, you know, 24 years, I guess.
Wow. Yeah.
In the chair. And certainly, I think 10 of those 24 years was really, really difficult, life, you know. But, you know, when you dig in deep and are really in touch. I mean, Ram Dass is an exceptional example, an exception of someone who could really be in touch with their Dharma so clearly, so mm-hmm. with so much purpose and so much singularity. You know, I think the rest of us are all kind of bouncing around going, well, I'm not sure what my Dharma is, but his was so clear and he was just so purposeful in every breath and every waking day, and truly amazing to watch him in those final years.
Yeah. His entire life and journey. I mean, you know, that old Gandhi quote, my life is my message. I just find Ram Dass's story. I mean, we can even kind of backtrack. I mean, I'm sure you're so sick of being asked this, but I mean, you are the son of Zach Leary. You grew up, you are the son of Timothy Leary. You grew up with both Timothy Leary as a father, people like Ram Dass in your life from a very young age. I mean, far out, that's got to be a unique upbringing, right? That's got to be an incredibly unique childhood that you had. What was your childhood like?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing about the childhood bit is it's really hard to be objective about it, because at the time you have no sense of objectivity. It's all you know. So you think the whole world is like that.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It wasn't until I was much older did I realize, oh, wow, the whole world was not like that. And it was truly exceptional. And having and all of these years later, you know, I really considered both my father, Timothy, and Ram Dass to be my primary teachers. And I think Timothy is, you know, really led me, you know, gave me a blueprint for how to master the art of the mind. And Ram Dass is about mastering the art of the heart. You know, so it's kind of two different paths that lead to the same place, one through the mind, one through the heart. But yeah, I mean, in respect to childhood, I mean, it was incredible. And I look back at it very fondly. You know, there were just so many incredible people around. I mean, that was really the gift. And I look back on that. It's like, wow, that's amazing. Just so many amazing thinkers and artists and musicians and rock stars and scientists and, you know, outlaws and
right.
and revolutionaries. And yeah, just, I was truly fortunate. You know, I mean, it's been a while now. I mean, my dad died a long time ago, but yeah, I remember it fondly.
It's incredible to see the differences of path that both those individuals took, I think. Yeah. I guess the framing I put it is like spiritualism versus activism. I've read, you know, a biography of your dad's life, you know, watched a number of documentaries and stuff. But, you know, for me, it kind of seems that, well, with good reason, Timothy Leary became the enemy number one from the system. So he really became quite activistic, I suppose, in the psychedelic movement, counterculture, rebellion. Whereas Ram Dass kind of actually, well, I guess, disengaged from the system, right?
I think also though, I mean, Timothy was also trying to disengage from the system, you know, which was why the system got so mad at him, because he was, you know, I mean, his primary mantra was really think for yourself and question authority. And
right.
There's a great phrase that Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead uses a lot when referring to himself. He says, I'm pathologically anti-authoritarian. And I just love that. And I say that about myself too. And certainly my father was that as well. He was pathologically anti-authoritarian. Anytime somebody told him, you know, this is how it should be done, he would say, fuck you, and do it another way, almost out of spite in
right.
a way.
Right.
I think that, not to get too personal into the psychology of Timothy Leary, but he had a tremendous amount of inner heartache, tragedy, of you know, real disappointment in his life. His first wife, Marianne, killed herself on his 35th birthday. His daughter, Susan, also took suicide. And every wife he married left him. I mean, and he was thrown in jail just for his ideas for 4 years and escaped. And he had a tremendous amount of anger. And I think that really drove him to become the personality that he was. Whereas, you know, I think Ram Dass too had a certain amount of anger, especially, you know, growing up in a time where being homosexual was very, very difficult, very, very challenging, and certainly affected him. But Ram Dass was able to channel that just, you know, so gracefully and so beautifully, and to seemingly work through it in a very different way than Timothy did. So, yeah, they're very different paths. But ultimately, I think, you know, if you really dive into their collective works, you see a lot of similarities and you see a lot of threads. And Ram Dass, you know, all the time that I spent with Ram Dass during the last decade of his life, which is considerable, a lot of hours personally with him, you know, I just wanted to talk about Maharaji. Mm. You know, that's all I wanted to. He just wanted to talk about Timothy.
Really?
And yeah, just constantly, you know, and I really think that in some ways, you know, Timothy was older than Ram Dass. I think in some ways, Timothy was really his first teacher, you know, not really his first guru, but certainly his first teacher, you know, and without Timothy, Ram Dass would have never made it to India and would have never met Maharaji and all of these things. And you know, R.D. stayed perpetually fascinated by his relationship with Timothy, you know, long after he was dead, which kind of told me a lot about their relationship. You know, it was really intense. There was at times some animosity, but really it was almost like, you know, John and Paul and the Beatles or something. It's like, yeah, they were these two best friends who butted heads, but they both know that they needed each other.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They needed each other. They had to have each other for the other to exist, you know?
Wow. Yeah. Kind of like brotherly love, I suppose, you know, there's a lot of butting heads with siblings, but it's nothing but love really at the end of the day.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I was telling this story just a couple weeks ago, but you know, when Timothy first found out he was sick and had cancer, and you know, that life was slipping away, the first person he called was Ram Dass, you know, for someone who claimed to be, you know, decidedly unspiritual. I really don't think that was true at all. I think he was actually deeply spiritual and was just very, had a lot to work out around that. But the first person he called was Ram Dass and sought his counsel and his love and his guidance, you know.
Yeah, yeah. What stage of, I suppose kind of when you were growing up, what stage of Timothy Leary's story was he at? I suppose all the psychedelic stuff had kind of happened. Was he much more into a kind of active, like political kind of mode, Timothy, or futurist mode, Timothy?
It's more the futurist mode.
Right, right.
Yeah, that was really, you know, by the time I came around and was, you know, conscious of who he was, the psychedelic years were behind him. I mean, he, you know, the best way to look at like the relationship that he had with psychedelics and his legacy, it's very much like going to see your favorite classic rock band, like say, I don't know, I mean, just say, you know, Led Zeppelin or something, right? I mean, they have so many great songs, right? But everybody wants them to play Stairway to Heaven.
Right.
It's like that was his greatest hit. And he knew that. And he never stopped talking about psychedelics, even in his latter day lectures. But he had moved so far past them. You know, of his 25 books, only 4 of them are overtly about psychedelics. The rest are about futurism, about, you know, psychology, the power of the mind, the 8-circuit model, autobiographical stuff. I mean, transhumanism, and then later into like, you know, cyber culture and the computer age, you know. Yeah, so by the time I was growing up, I mean, he was really he was futurist, Timothy, and really, you know, I mean, God, he was really touting the power of the internet long before it became what it became.
Yeah. I heard you speak on another podcast recently, kind of talking about the futurist, I guess, predicament that we find ourselves in, artificial intelligence just blowing up and social media and all this stuff. And you seem to have a much more, embracing holistic kind of view on technology and futurism, uh-huh. which I think is really, really good. You in this conversation, you put it, you know, this has all happened. It's really overwhelming for people to comprehend where our species is going. But as you put it, this has been written about and, sci-fi and all sorts of stuff. These ideas have been well and truly been waiting to happen for decades. You know, this is inevitable. This is completely inevitable. I found that a really interesting way, to view it. It's not an accident that this is happening.
Yeah.
It's been begging.
It's not an accident. And it's also, like you just said, it's inevitable. Like the train has left the station, right. And, a lot of people in, the kind of mystical arts community and like yoga and so forth, there's still a very strong kind of distaste for it and the get back to nature movement and kind of shutting all this stuff off. And I agree, we really have to, find balance with it. We can't, Douglas Rushkoff wrote a great book called Program or Be Programmed. We can really control the algorithm. We can really be in charge of our relationship with tech rather than letting it, take us over. I do think that there is still choice involved. You have to really get ahead of the curve and learn how to use these tools properly in a way that they don't become, manipulative and really, guide your worldview and your bubble. It's difficult though, because a lot has happened so quickly. Certainly younger people who are, maybe 25 years and younger than that, they were born into it and they don't know any different. But for everyone else, I really think it's a challenging predicament we find ourselves in, because it is so easy to kind of get swept up by the so-called algorithm and to let the algorithm kind of, morph our thought patterns and morph our point of view without realizing that we have the power to disrupt the algorithm. And the algorithm is designed to cause separation. The algorithm is designed to keep us in a specific echo chamber, so all the ones and zeros can sort of be marketed to us and kind of keep us there and create segments and create very neat and tidy packages that we can be marketed to and manipulated. But I think tech certainly becomes a lot more egalitarian, a lot more freeing when you realize the algorithm can be busted and that you can break it apart.
Right. You worked in tech for quite a while, didn't you?
I did. Yeah, I did.
You've got the full spectrum, you've I mean, kind of the imprints of these incredibly larger than life people also kind of reflecting in your life. You've got this incredibly rich spiritual practice that I suppose is kind of where we met, the psychedelic aspect but not shying away from the technology. I think it's a very healthy way to approach life and this bizarre experience, right? What were the biggest imprints left on you by, growing up with Timothy Leary and people like Ram Dass? And were they the biggest influences on you as a young man or teen?
It's a good question. Well, certainly Ram Dass came later for me. Right. I of course grew up with Ram Dass and he was around all the time and I got to know him very well. But when I was a young teenager, 14, 15, 16 in there, quite frankly, Ram Dass freaked me out. You know, anytime he'd come around, it was like, here is this guy who was just beaming all of the time. And I was just like, fuck, man, what is this trip he's on? You know, it's like, it just was too much for me to even handle. But, you know, I read Be Here Now when I was 16, and I, you know, it introduced me to Indian spirituality and certainly got acquainted with it. But I didn't really dive into the teachings well into my 20s. So Ram Dass was a constant figure when I was a teen, but his influence came later. I mean, I'd have to say, though, that the biggest imprints in my childhood and my teenage years were the musicians, you know, music, the Church of Rock and Roll is my first church. You know, I grew up with the Grateful Dead, following the Grateful Dead around the country. And that was certainly my first church. And it's still very near and dear to my heart to this day. But, you know, the spirit of the Grateful Dead, and not just their music, but, you know, that whole kind of bubble of related music, was really, you know, my first imprints on, you know, what it meant to really love art and pick it apart and to listen to lyrics and to find beauty in music and to find beauty in community and to understand what craftsmanship meant and what songwriting meant and poetry and, you know, things like the Grateful Dead led me to American roots music and to discover like what guys like, you know, Robert Johnson meant to the American experience and black jazz and blues and things like that. So certainly, I'd say rock and roll was the biggest thing. And, you know, whatever access I had to those guys whenever they came around, that was the most thrilling moment for me, you know, like, you know, and David Gilmour from Pink Floyd would come around and that would just like blow me away. You know, that was when I got most excited. You know, the movie stars and, you know, that was okay. That was fine. But anytime like a rock star that really changed my life came around, that would just, oh my God, I turned into a little.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're following the Grateful Dead around, I'm sure there was a fair bit of psychedelic experimenting and probably playing around with some drugs as most people, you know, most, I don't know, adventurous, rebellious young people and exploring those things might do. Was I suppose early days experimenting with things like psychedelics, was that somewhat of a, in your mind, a rebellion from like your dad or your parents?
You know? Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it was a huge part of the ethos and of the trip was to rebel against your parents and get out whenever you could and get in the back of a van or a station wagon and go follow this traveling circus around the country. You know, when I first started following the Grateful Dead, you know, in spite of what people think, you know, my parents were not supportive. You know, they were like, you're too young. You're too young. Trust me. Don't start using LSD yet. Like, you'll want to wait till you're older. Your prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed. Trust me. Of course they didn't listen, you know, and, you know, once I probably hit about 16, then my parents became friends with the whole idea and, you know, it was happening and we found a great kind of symbiosis with it. But those early days, they were certainly all about rebellion, not just against my parents, but against school, against work, against society. You know, it was kind of the last kind of gasp of, you know, true American 1960s counterculture. And it was just thrilling to be a part of, you know.
I can only imagine, man.
Yeah. So much fun. So much fun.
Yeah. You said Ram Dass came to you later. How did Ram Dass or the spiritual path, whatever that means, enter your life? And why?
Well, yeah, no, the why is a really good question. I mean, you know, like I said, you know, I did discover Eastern spirituality when I was a teenager and there was something there, like even when I was 17, 18, there was something there that I kind of gravitated towards. Be Here Now was incredibly influential to me. And simultaneously around that time, I had a high school friend who dropped out of high school and joined the Hare Krishna movement, the ISKCON movement. And I watched him do that. And, you know, back then in the 80s, early 90s, around that time, ISKCON was far more aggressive around recruiting. Right. They were very, very aggressive around that. But I would kind of go to temple now and then to go check it out. And in spite of the hardcore recruiting and all of that, there was something beautiful that I saw with the chanting of the names of, you know, kirtan. And it did plant this deep seed in me. So that seed was planted, but then I kind of took a right turn and started working in corporate life, you know, as a digital marketer and tech consultant for many years. And you know, I sort of ended up, that's a whole other can of worms, but I kind of did that whole career sort of by default. It just sort of fell into my life and I just kind of rode with it. Part of it was also thinking that I needed to establish my own identity that was as far away from Timothy's as possible. So right. It seemed to kind of make sense a little bit, but it really didn't. And it really, I'm one of those cases, you know, I worked in that industry full time for about 13 years. And about year 10, I hit a spiritual wall, a bankruptcy, a wall, you know, and I was like, you know, I'm just miserable. You know, sure, the paycheck is okay, but, you know, I'm going to wake up at age 80 wondering where my whole life went, you know, and I didn't want to be that person. I really don't know how or why, but I started kind of dusting off the old Ram Dass tapes and books and started practicing yoga at my local yoga studios and getting into meditation, and these things just kind of started to kind of grab a hold of me. And then one day a friend and I were talking, a friend named Dean, and we were like, wow, you know, we haven't seen Ram Dass in a few years since he moved to Maui after he left the mainland. It'd been 5 years since I'd seen him. And in 2008, I went to go visit Ram Dass. And after just being in the middle of this, you know, spiritual bankruptcy, and it was one of those moments that, you know, I think that most people on the spiritual path have that moment where you know your life will never be the same, you know, and that was true for me. Yeah. You know, it was just that visit with Ram Dass. It was just the right place, the right time. And it was like I had met him for the first time. It wasn't the first time. I'd spent lots of time with him, but it was like I had really met him for the first time on that trip. And that was, I think, the fall of 2008, maybe. And it just came over me like a beautiful, warm wave. And yeah, and really put me in touch with what I needed to change in my life. You know, I had suffered. I mean, certainly I was having a lot of career angst and depression around that. But, you know, I'd also suffered a lot of substance abuse problems in and out of my life. And a lot of things became clear then. I mean, when you asked why, I think that was a huge part of the why was, you know, a lot of the way my shadow side manifested and took a hold of me was really gripping and really difficult and very, very sad and challenging. And, you know, that path just really helped me to uncover that and to kind of give myself a little bit of love, you know?
Yeah. Life's work, man, isn't it? We're not all just like, we all think that we're intrinsically good people, but life's complicated. It's sticky. Things happen, you know, we get faced with hard decisions and, you know, substance abuse and all sorts of stuff. Right. I mean, I've just recently kind of quit booze because I've also just feel like better without it, right? You know, it's but it's
hard.
Well, psychedelics helped. Okay. I've been off it for a year, and then I just had a bit of a drink over Christmas, and I've just after that had my first disgusting hangover, and just thought, you know what? Nah. I don't know who knows how long it'll go for. Hopefully a while, but it's easier not to, right? It's easier not to confront those things. But I guess sometimes it's just 100% necessary.
Yeah, you're right. It can be easier not to, but you know, you'll have to eventually.
Right. Right.
You know? No one here gets out alive, man. You know, you're going to have to eventually, you know. I mean, ignorance is bliss, or just, you know, whatever you use to avoid, you know, the stark nature of your own personality, of your own incarnation. And everybody has one, you know. There's no, everybody has a shadow side.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them, you know, more pronounced than others. I'll grant that. There's no doubt. But, you know, I think, you know, that's one thing I love about Buddhism so much, is that, you know, the story of the Buddha, here was this young prince who came from just a world of privilege, you know. And then when he started to see the nature of the world, that suffering was around every turn, every corner, everybody had a degree of suffering. If when it was the poor beggar on the street or the king, everybody had suffering with access, and that was part of their lives. And confronting that as the first kind of tenet of Buddhism, of the struggle of just being alive, is that we're all prone to suffering, you know, and how do you get through that with grace? It's challenging.
Yeah, sure is. I was saying, like, earlier when I was kind of starting to talk about Ram Dass and that Gandhi quote, "My life is my message." I mean, that's one thing that I've always found about Ram Dass, is his life story has just been an incredibly inspiring guide for me. And honestly, whenever I found myself in difficult times, or experiencing friction, or even hate or disdain for people, I've literally come back and thought, what would Ram Dass do? How would Ram Dass approach this? But you know, yeah, I mean, he's literally, in early days of exploring psychedelics, I mean, it is a massive shock to the psychological system. It can completely change who you are. I feel like it changed who I am, not like a personality shift, but in a very, very positive way for me. That's not to say that a lot of people can have really challenging times with psychedelics. And I suppose having no guidance, you know, like I'm sure you're, you know, with various circles that you've come with, you've got the spiritual side, you've got the esoteric side, you've got the sacred geometry, which kind of just becomes like very close to church art, really. You know, like I'm not trying to shit on any of that stuff. Like it's beautiful in its own right, but some people get very obsessed with the interdimensional beings, like that definitely exist, and other people get much more connected to their soulful self or nature, or it can really go in very confusing ways if you let it. And one thing I've found about Ram Dass's story, and including things like the stroke and then failing the test and then getting back on the horse and actually crystallizing into just a glowing being as times even got tougher for him, has just been a magical rock to kind of hold on to throughout my journey. It's been a lot to relate to and stuff. And it's, incredible.
No, beautifully said. And you know, one thing I love about Ram Dass, almost, I think, more so than any of the modern Western spiritual teachers, is that he was able to talk about all of his behaviors and all of his life and
imperfections,
you know, all of his imperfections,
right,
you know,
right,
with humor and you know, and sharing his struggles and you know, right there in all of his talks. And he always thought, like, the greatest sin was to be phony holy, as he would call it. You know, you have to share all of it, you know. And I truly love that about Ram Dass. And God, yeah. I mean, some of the best talks we ever had were certainly about our imperfections.
Right.
You know. Yeah. There's no doubt that that's great that you play that tape when in times of struggle, because RD probably went through it at some point.
Hey, I fall short a lot. Don't worry. You know.
Yeah.
How was, you know, it's been a while since we've hung out. I'm just so constantly grateful and amazed that I managed to stumble across that incredible community, be able to spend a brief moment with Ramdas. You know, a lot's happened since then. How was Ramdas's passing? How was that for you? Spiritually speaking, you've known this man your entire life. He's the figurehead of this beautiful satsang spiritual family that's helped so many people. You know, when he talks about Maharaji's death, there's that quote saying, you know, Maharaji would say, "Don't be sad. Where could I go?" And that's a beautiful thing. And I can understand that, but I can't feel that. Death still means death to me. Mm-hmm. I understand it, and that's beautiful that people can have this, like, hey, he's not gone anywhere, man. He's with us right now. But, you know, that's maybe slightly out of the capacity of my full comprehension.
Yeah, I mean, look, I really do understand that, because there is certainly a degree of finality to death. You know, it's like, you know, one moment they're here, one moment they're not,
right?
You know, in physical form. I mean, I certainly credit my dad for kind of giving me a little bit of a primer. I mean, I was 22 when he died, and I have learned over the years to call him in, you know, in various moments in my life. And that has helped me a lot. You know, it can get very esoteric and it can get very ephemeral, you know, because it's almost kind of in a place beyond language. And it's a practice, you know, it really is a practice. You know, I do think it kind of gets down to the nature of consciousness and viewing, you know, kind of pushing you to expand your definition of what you think consciousness is. You know, I definitely think consciousness is a disembodied collective entity that we all have access to. And, you know, we all kind of get like the Alan Watts thing. We have a television antenna kind of that beams into the collective stream of consciousness. But when someone dies, certainly we miss them, but it doesn't mean that their consciousness ceases to exist. You know, their language, you know, their verbal kind of meat suit representation of that consciousness ceases to exist, but you can certainly tap into it. But Ramdas's death specifically couldn't have come at a more difficult time for me. There's no doubt about that. I was, for one, look, we knew Ramdas couldn't go on forever.
Right.
I mean, that was one thing. It was like, look, he had many near-death experiences, you know, over the last 10 years, you know. So we knew it could happen at any time. But, yeah, I was in a very challenging space at that point, personally, just was going through some personal stuff, really, really hard. And exactly 1 week before Ramdas died, my cat died. And this is my cat of 16 years. And my cat was, you know, kind of my best friend in a way. I know people who aren't pet people might not get that, but, you know, I had a very deep, deep connection to my cat. And I had him for 16 years and he died and I already wasn't in the best place. And then the day he died, Ramdas called me to kind of, Ramdas also liked cats and he just called to express his love, but I missed the call. And I didn't call him back. I thought, okay, I'll call him back in a few days once I kind of get my shit together. Then he died. And it was kind of like this 1-2 punch for me. It's like my cat and Ram Dass, and I missed Ram Dass's call. That would have been the last time I ever spoke to him. And I was like, oh my God, how could I have missed it? And I was like, oh, it was just so much grief, so much sadness for me. You know, but I did manage to kind of turn a corner, and, you know, I kind of got myself back to, I think, in a much healthier place, a much more conscious place, and dealt with my own sadness and suffering. And yeah, you know, I certainly will miss looking into Ram Dass's eyes, of course, you know, and just being in that presence. I will. Yet I still feel, you know, I tap into him all the time, all the time. And he left such, it's also helpful that he left such a incredible body of work behind us, behind for us, right. You know, putting on his tapes and lectures, and, you know, that helps a lot.
Yeah.
No question. Yeah,
absolutely. Do you?
It's hard though. It's hard.
Yeah. I'm yeah. Also so sorry to hear about that really difficult time, man. And I can only imagine. I mean, yeah, I can only imagine. It was when Ram Dass passed as well. It was, I think I'm pretty sure I was going through a bit of a shit one as well. And it was, it's one of those things, like, you know, I didn't grow up with him. There's a lot of removal for me. I'm living in Australia compared to you. You know, I've just listened to a lot of his teachings and stuff. I was lucky enough to spend a brief amount of time with him, but it hurt. Yeah, like it was rough. It was and again, listening to how he probably, you know, talks about Maharaji leaving, I almost felt like that was a failure to really be that attached to the physical body. I mean, he was very old. We all knew, like you said, we all knew he was going to die at any year, really. But it was sad. It was sad for me. Do you?
Yeah, you know.
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, do you think, you know, hearing about things like Maharaji and these are saints and meant to be enlightened beings and things. I mean, do you think, I suppose, enlightenment is achievable? Do you personally think it's achievable? And do you think Ram Dass was enlightened?
Mm.
And what is enlightenment?
Right. Yeah. Oh man. That's a really big question, Jack. Yeah, I think the modern world certainly creates more obstacles for enlightenment than kind of a simpler time did. I think that's why there really aren't too many living Indian saints these days who are really the real deal. You know, I mean, there are some, and you can certainly encounter some pretty extraordinary holy men in India still to this day. But the modern world certainly creates a lot more obstacles to where, like, you know, a Ramana Maharshi, a Ramakrishna, you know, all of those guys, and Maharaji, and the original Sai Baba, not the later one, but the original one, you know, like guys like that just don't really exist today. You know, maybe it's because the complexities of the modern world and it's very hard to just exist today. Like, you have to, you know, everybody plays a part of a system and has to pay their taxes, and it's very hard to just be today, you know. India still kind of has a fabric for that, still creates, you know, gives a lot of leverage to people who are holy men, and they can just kind of be. But it's very, very, very difficult for that. I mean, I think, look, I mean, you've done a lot of psychedelics, and you understand, and as well as other spiritual practices, and you understand, like, the dichotomy between awakened consciousness and a non-ordinary state of consciousness, and what it means to actually be in a non-ordinary state of consciousness, to dance in that plane of complete oneness with everything, where you can just pierce the veil of reality just like that, snap right through it and just see all the bullshit of your own incarnation, of others, of the way the world operates, but also see the beauty and the harmony of what it means to just be in love with the one and just hang out in that place. And psychedelics give you a tremendous, tremendous glimpse into that reality. And I think, as far as I can tell, I think that's what enlightenment is. I think it's just having that ability just to jump into that reality and to kind of stay there. Mm. And guys like, Maharaji, most likely had that ability to do it. I mean, we certainly know the story of Ram Dass giving him 1,000 mics of LSD and it doing nothing to him.
Yeah.
Because there is, like Ram Dass would say, if you don't get on a bus to Detroit when you're already in Detroit.
Right.
But Ram Dass, yeah, I think Ram Dass was certainly a realized being. Hmm. Did he achieve full enlightenment in the yogic system? We would call that free from birth. I think he was damn close near it. Really, really close. Ram Dass certainly had, he certainly had siddhis, yogic powers that were real. He could do things with just his gaze of unconditional love that could pierce straight through you.
He was intense.
Very intense.
He gave me one of those really prolonged looks. I kind of freaked out, man. I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
I kind of freaked out. I was like, just surrender, yeah. just take it in, but it really did.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was talking about when I was a teenager, and right. He would do that, and I was like, yeah, I don't know what that is,
Yeah.
And it's hard just to take that in, and Ram Dass could really, really do it. And was he enlightened? I don't know, because he's certainly was in touch with his humanity. There's no question about that as well. But he was damn near it, damn close.
Mm-hmm. Zach, you are facilitating psychedelic retreats these days. That's awesome.
And one-on-one privately as well.
Oh, cool. When did this all start?
It started about 7 years ago.
Great.
Yeah, it was kind of doing it pretty quietly. I first started doing it about 7 years ago, but about 5 years ago, I really started to ramp up my practice and really take the methodology a lot more seriously and how I work with people in different conditions, different people, different issues, and working with the medicines. And I've been doing it. I do it quite often. I've worked with well over 100 people now one-on-one, but yeah, I'm going to also this month going to start working in Jamaica at a psilocybin retreat center there called Evolution Retreats.
It looks beautiful. It looks so beautiful. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really, really beautiful spot. I mean, anyone listening, of course, I encourage you to go. I'm just a facilitator there. I don't run the place. Sadly, it is very expensive, but it's also a vacation. It's really beautiful. Beautiful spot. Yeah, it's great work. It certainly put me in touch with my call to service.
Serving, right? Yeah. Well, I mean, that was always a massive lesson in the Ram Dass world is serve, right?
Serve. Yeah. And that's the best manifestation that I've had of it. It's been great.
Do you use a kind of combination of your, I suppose, spiritual understanding or practice combined with, this incredible window into this? I mean, you're at the psychedelic epicenter, right? Just upbringing and everything. You must have learned a thing or two about these substances.
Yeah, no, I do for sure. I mean, my main mission in this world is to is to keep the mysticism alive. You know, in the last 10 years, the rise of the medicalization of psychedelics, you know, specifically as psychedelics relate to mental health issues, has become incredibly popular. And for good reason. You know, they're very effective, and they can certainly disrupt the mental health industry in ways that we've never seen. However, the administration of them, I think, has become very sterile, very medicalized, very dry.
Right.
And yeah, in my sessions, we can't get into all the details, but I do a bhakti yoga puja to start. I do a Hanuman puja at the beginning of every session. So I definitely infuse, the work and the teachings that I learned from Ram Dass into this. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I try my best to anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. What is the importance of the mystical experience in, I guess, relating to spirituality or one's connection to their truer self or their divine self, however you want to put that, that moment that we can get clarity and incredible benefits from psychedelics that can lead us to self-assess, see and love and you know what? Why is the mystical side of psychedelics important to spirituality?
Well, I think, you know, in the psychedelic experience, no matter what it is that happens to you, whatever benefit that you get from a psychedelic journey, the nature of that transformation is mystical. Whether or not you want to call it that or not, for people who are, you know, maybe spiritually, you know, agnostic or want nothing to do with that, you know, you can't escape it. You know, it's a byproduct of the psychedelic experience, you know, the merging with the one, the kind of disillusion of your ego, the ability to kind of, or the gift, I should say, the experience of being able to see all these different parts of yourself kind of shatter and cascade and break apart right in front of you into just a kind of a kaleidoscope of different selves and different parts and behaviors and thoughts and patterns and things like that. Whereas like, say, the opposite of that would be like, say, modern psychiatric medicines that really go to treat the symptoms, you know, that regulate certain chemicals in your brain and serotonin levels or dopamine levels or whatever it is. You know, they're really like band-aids that go to regulate the chemistry in your brain, whereas psychedelics don't do that. They offer you an experience, which is the medicine, a self-reflective, referential experience that transforms you in ways that are the very essence of what a mystical, journey is all about. And, the interesting thing about that is, you know, for most of mankind's existence on this planet, mysticism in some form or another, ritual, community, prayer, dancing, esotericism, all of these things were a core part of every single culture around the globe. You know, ancient Rome was pagan. It wasn't Christian. You know, look at the Eclusian mysteries in ancient Greece where they were drinking, you know, ergot, sort of an LSD type of liquid. And, you know, but the psychedelic society, you know, every culture has a huge degree of celebratory and revelatory mystical experience. Since the industrial age, you know, that's kind of gotten lost. You know, the industrial age really kind of dampened that to a great deal, you know, really dampened that. And, the Judeo-Christian religions, or I should say the Abrahamic religions, which includes Islam, you know, they offer you a connection to God, but they make it very, you know, dualistic and very external and very rule-based and very much based on what you can and cannot do and the nature of sin and repentance and heaven and hell and right and wrong and morality and all of these things. And they've kind of stripped away the essence of what it means to just kind of hang out and, you know, dance and play and revel in God's energy. Mm-hmm. And even some of those religions, like even in Islam, like you have Sufi mystics and Qawwali mystics. If you listen to Qawwali music today, it's a you know, it's a Sufism is a part of Islam, and that just absolutely, you know, it's all about, you know, this sparking that that mystical core, that seed that's inside of us all. And I think you know, psychedelics are a great way to jumpstart that. It's not a method in and of itself, you know, if you just isolate it and feel the need to do it over and over and over again and chase the peak experience. But I do think it can spark you and lead you into a mystical sense of awareness, I think, if you're doing it right anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ram Dass, he would say something like, I'll probably butcher this, but psychedelics can give you, you know, can put you in the room for an hour with Christ, whereas love can allow you to stay, I suppose, something like that. You know, it's a window, not a way. It can like exactly what you said. It can spark that journey. It can reinvigorate the path, the quest of of whatever that is: purity, happiness, love, enlightenment,
all of it.
Yep. Have you ever had any, throughout your spiritual journey, have you ever had any mystical psychedelic experiences that have just completely not involved psychedelics at all?
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, many of them. I mean, countless, countless.
What's got you there?
Many, you know, and I also want to say, too, I want to preface this because this is a good question. I really want to preface it. You know, one thing that really is a pet peeve and it grinds my gears when somebody tells me, oh, I don't need psychedelics, I can get there doing XYZ. and, you know, and I take exception to that because it's not the same, you know. The metaphor that I like to use is they're different rides in the same amusement park. You know, if you've been to Disneyland, you know, going on Space Mountain is not the same thing as going on It's a Small World. You know, they're different. It's the same vibe, but it is different. So it's like, yeah, you can get to a similar place, but they are all different. They all take you to different kind of corners of the same universe, and they're not the same. But certainly kirtan and mantra, breath work, flotation tanks, and meditation have all taken me there. But I mean, kirtan is, you know, the first time I really got just zapped in a kirtan. You know, the whole room was just on fire and lifting and just this beautiful energy in it. And I had realized that for the past however many minutes, I literally wasn't thinking about anything else but the mantra.
Right, right.
I literally was just in repetition of the mantra and the energy that came as a result of the recitation of it. And I was just lost in that for however many minutes. And yeah, maybe it was 20, 30 minutes later, it occurred to me, wow, my thoughts actually stopped. You know, and I just couldn't believe it because I was a skeptic. I didn't think that, you know, that could work in that way.
Yeah.
But it did. It really did. And I mean, God, we could do a whole podcast on why mantra and kirtan and Sanskrit mantras, why they work the way that they do. But it did. It worked. And it still does. I mean, you know, I still sing every single day. And it's just one of the few methods that work for me in a way that actually gets my, you know, we're talking about Ram Dass so much today, but really gets my melodramas to quiet down.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but there are others too, you know, flotation tanks, breath work. They've all certainly taken me to pretty far out places, you know. And that is, it's also an important question too in relationship to psychedelics because, you know, look, psychedelics are very popular right now. Again, you know, we're in a huge renaissance around psychedelics, but I am not a zealot around them. I don't believe that they are the only path there. They are one path, but I really just believe that they should be treated with equal respect and legitimacy as all these other methods, you know?
Yeah. Right. I'm glad you mentioned kirtan, because I had a very similar experience. When I first went to Hawaii retreat, I'd never heard of kirtan. For the listeners, if you don't know, kirtan is it's chanting. It's beautiful. There'll be one guide, singer and chanter or musicians, and they will sing a line, and then the audience will sing back. Is that a good summary, I suppose?
Yeah, call and response chant. Yeah,
right. And I'd never heard of it. I'd never heard of Krishna Das at all. I don't know how. and just stumbled into this world. You know, it was exactly what you said. It managed to quiet my mind. It managed to get me to a place where I felt that I was on MDMA without having taken anything. I felt alive. And it also really challenged me, because going into that whole world, I had, probably a lot more real resistance to religion. I mean, I kind of still do to an extent, but I don't care as much, you know. But I remember having one moment where most of them are in Sanskrit, and there was this one that Krishna Das was singing about. It was in English, and it was a Jesus song. It was all about Jesus. And I really struggled with that. And I was like, but I was also like, that's interesting. Why is that prodding you so much? I mean, it's the same message. It's the exact same thing. It's just in a context that you have resisted. But that's that, like right there, that was shining the light on my contradictions, right? You know, going in, you know, screw Christianity and the Bible and blah, 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 blah. But this romantic Eastern religions is fantastic for me right now. But it's all roads, all paths leading to the top of the mountain.
That's right. So let me ask you this. After that first retreat and you discovering Sanskrit mantras and kirtan, did it affect your art?
I'm not sure. It affected my life. It affected my happiness. I think you know, this idea of the struggling artist, I think is kind of bullshit. I think depression totally kills creativity. I think being alive and happy and vibrating at a you know, intoxicating rate only helps creativity. So I mean, I think it definitely helped my creativity. I think the biggest shift of my art was you know, my first large doses of psychedelics. That was when my art really took a sharp left turn for the better.
I bet your art is very psychedelic.
Thanks. It was very drab and very shit before that. grayscale buildings and things like that at university. Really, really awful stuff. I hope none of them exist anymore. But I mean, yeah, look, I think a rich life helps creativity. You know, I think a happy, rich life really, really directly affects people's creativity, well, at least for me personally. I mean, there's a lot of incredibly beautiful, sad music and great art that actually some of my favorite art is really dark. Oh, I'm saying that, yeah. I'm undoing everything that I'm saying.
So much of it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, God, so much of my favorite art, of course. But I do think with music, though, I do think that in order, I mean, this is a big thing to say, but I do believe that it's true that not 100% of the time, but most of the time, in order to become a really great, profound musician or singer, that you do have to experience some kind of suffering. You do have to know what suffering and desperation and quiet desperation really feels like. You don't have to stay there and hang out there for the rest of your career.
Right.
Of course, you can move on to joy and bliss and staying there, but you have to know what that kernel of suffering feels like to become a great musician. I mean, all my favorite musicians certainly have had a degree of that.
Yeah.
You know.
I totally agree with you. Speaking of creativity, I was checking out your website. You've been making some beautiful art too, Zach, and looks very Rothko inspired.
Yeah, it is. Look, it's all digital. I'm not a painter. I can dabble with paints. It's all it's all digital, and yes, very Rothko inspired. But it's just for fun. I like it. But they look really cool when they're printed out really big.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. They're fun to play with in that scenario. Yeah.
What do you like about Rothko? Why does Rothko strike a nerve for you?
Yeah. So when you're actually sitting in front of them in real life and in the three-dimensional world, not just seeing a picture of it, like just sitting in front of those big, you know, they're large canvases. Huge. For people who don't know. Yeah, they're really big. And they're usually, not all the time, but they're usually, when they're shown in a gallery, there's usually more than one of them side by side. They just instantly create a mood for me. Mm. They have a kind of this tangibility of just changing kind of the air between my eyes and the painting. Like the air just gets changed, and I just feel the density of it. I know he was also a very tortured dude. There's no question. He's a tortured soul. But just feeling that energetic shift, that what happens when you just sit in front of them. And I just love them. One of my favorites. I know they're not for everyone. My girlfriend doesn't get it. Every time we go to a museum and I see them, she's like, babe, I don't get it. And she says, oh, well. And I just sit in front of them for 20 minutes and just lose myself in them. I just love them.
I mean, I think that was kind of his total intention, wasn't it? It was like the scale was very intentional, being really overwhelming to create almost, get rid of to encompass the peripherals. And it was a sense of trying to instill a sense of the sublime, right? Kind of,
yeah.
Or divine, exactly. Even, which I love. I love the sublime is a very... I love that subject. That's in terms of art. That's really... what excites me, trying to create feelings of the sublime, I suppose.
That's a beautiful, beautiful sentiment. Have you ever seen in person like a James Turrell installation?
Yeah. Quite a few. We've got some down in Tasmania at MoNA. He's incredible, right? Incredible.
Just wild, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. And just that feeling of the sublime, because at first it's just so subtle, you know, just playing with everything that's already in front of us, light, shapes, colors, you know, but then just if you just hang out with it more and more, you really just get taken to this sublime, quiet, nuanced place. And they're incredible.
And they do play with your perception too, right? Like sometimes there'll just be a big rectangle cut out and the lights are so subtle, you really can't tell if this is just a shape or a hole into a whole nother space. Like they're really trippy the way that someone can actually do that with shape and light and space. It's being in a painting, isn't it?
Yes, so trippy. Oh my God, so trippy. Yeah, when he took over the Guggenheim in New York, you know, the famous spiral, and you just sit at the bottom of the spiral and looked up. I just remember, like, and I wasn't tripping. I know I wasn't, but just everything just broke away, you know, and there was just like this just cone of just like extraterrestrial nothingness. It was fantastic.
love it. It's making me tingle. Zach, you've written a book as well. This is to come out.
I'm writing a book.
Oh, okay, cool. I'm
writing a book. Yeah, almost done. It will come out with the next year.
I love the title. And Now the Work Begins. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. My publisher and I are going back and forth on the title.
I love the title. I love it.
Okay. Oh, well, thank you. So you know. And now the work begins: psychedelics in the 21st century and how to use them.
Mm. Is this a book about your personal journey? Is it objectively just kind of looking at the psychedelic movement?
It's more the latter. I mean, there's some autobiographical stuff in there, of course. Some telling stories of things that I've had the great fortune to have witnessed in psychedelic moment. But yeah, it's really commentary on the history of psychedelics from the 50s until now. Everything that happened in the 50s, the 60s, you know, and then into this modern renaissance, really kind of looking at this explosion that we've seen and kind of analyzing, exploring, critiquing a lot of the good stuff, but also some of the stuff that I think we should course correct. But it also provides a lot of instruction for how people can use psychedelics safely and effectively.
Fantastic. Well, I'll definitely be getting myself a coffee. Also, just to you're hosting, you are the host of the MAPS podcast, Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. That is where all the, I suppose, cutting edge research into psychedelic studies is going down. I mean, do you get intimidated talking to these scientists that are just like absolute ridiculous brainy? I mean, you're an incredibly intelligent guy yourself, but, you know, it must be.
I'm not a scientist though. No, I'm not a scientist at all, you know, at all. Yeah, well, when I have to do an interview with like an actual researcher, you know, I mean, they alternate between researchers and cultural people. But when I have to interview a researcher, it requires a lot of homework, you know.
I was about to ask, right.
I just can't wing those. Some of the others, I can just wing it. Mm. But those, it's like, yeah, no, I mean, there's they're big brains, you know, they're big brains and they're doing big things and into you know, worlds, you know, I know nothing about neuroscience or neuroimaging or fMRIs or, you know, it's something I've had to learn. But you know, what also makes it great is look, all the people doing work in that space, they're also psychonauts themselves. So they're incredibly lovely people and make it very easy and accessible.
You know? Right. But I mean, well done for like taking that on. That sounds like quite intimidating for me, but we really need kind of normies to make it digestible for the general public. I think, you know, two scientists talking, it would be fascinating, but the audience narrows, I think, when it's that and an everyman person. I guess that's why, you know, people like Joe Rogan were so popular, right? Because he started talking to big brains from just an average person. But I love that. So anyway, well done. And
thank you.
It's all happening. Is that going to come back? That was on my very frequent podcast rotation.
Oh, you're sweet. Thank you. One day, once the book is done.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Awesome.
Just only so much bandwidth.
Yep. Of course, man. Of course. Yeah. Zach, man, thank you so much for coming on. Awesome to catch up with you, dude. I'm really looking forward to the next time. Hopefully I can get back over to the States in the next few years and swing by Austin or maybe Hawaii. But
you always have a place. You have a place to stay here.
Thanks, man. You're welcome anytime. Appreciate it. Awesome. Is there anything else that you want to kind of plug or get people's eyes on?
Oh, well, I do an online course, a psychedelic studies intensive that begins on February 8th, which is an online course and online live real time. It's not pre-recorded content behind a paywall. It's all interactive in a virtual classroom. And there's 8 weeks, 8 different modules of deep psychedelic studies. It begins on February 8th.
Hell yeah, that sounds awesome. I might jump on board. Thank you, Zach. Much love, much appreciation for everything you do. And thanks everyone for listening. Take care. Bye.